On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we have Mr. Brian Chee, Mr. Curtis Franklin here today. And this week, we actually talk about a security bug in the latest version of iOS that when you connect to a malicious Wi-Fi network, it actually do some malicious things to your device. Not good. Plus, we also have a great guest today. Now, does your organization deploy applications that might be API-driven? Well, do you maintain your own authorization stack as well as maybe other properties in the cloud? Well, today we have Nathaniel Coffing. He's co-founder and CSO of Cloud Entity, and he's going to take us through how organizations can have better fine-grained authorization with even policy enforcement. You shouldn't miss it. It's Wyatt on The Set.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 449, recorded June 25th, 2021. We want open banking. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Bitwarden. Get the password manager that offers a robust, cost-effective solution that can drastically increase your chances of staying safe online. Get started with a free trial of the Teams or Enterprise plan, or try it for free across all devices as an individual user at bitwarden.com/twit. And by Thanks Canary. Detect attackers on your network while avoiding irritating false alarms. Get the alerts that matter. For 10% off and a 60-day money-back guarantee, go to canary.tools/twit. Enter the code TWIT in the How Do You Hear About Us box. Welcome to TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I am your host, Louis Maresca, your guide through this big world of the enterprise. But if I can't guide you by myself, I need to bring in the professionals, the experts in their field, starting with our very own enterprise and security expert. He's a senior analyst at Omdia, and he is Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, Black Hat 2021 is coming up in a little over a month. Can you give us a little bit of a tease? What's going on there?
Well, the biggest tease that I can give is that we've been given clearance to go ahead and book our travel, so I'll definitely be there in person. And It looks like a lot of other people will be there in person as well, so really looking forward to that. Although I will say that my part of Black Hat, the Omdia Summit, will be virtual. So even if you can't travel to Las Vegas, you can hear what I and the other Omdia cybersecurity analysts have to say about the state of the market, the universe, and everything having to do with cybersecurity. Should be a lot of fun.
Fantastic. Looking forward to it. Well, speaking of experts, we also have our network and security expert and an all-around tech geek, Mr. Brian Chee. Cheebert, how's the world taking over the world one firewall line at a time going?
I'm still waiting on AT&T to tell me I can get fiber. You know, I'm really looking forward to this only because the word I'm getting is this is not their standard U-verse fiber. U-verse is basically symmetrical gig. So rumor has it this is going to be the next step up, which might be the rumored 2.5 gig symmetrical service, which could be pretty amazing. I got to go and read the fine print very closely because I'm trying to see if there is a commercial version where I can actually sublet. That way I could go and provide fast services within the neighborhood, which could be a lot of fun. But my big trick this week is I finally found a bunch of my sensors. So I'm going to start building a few, and I get to go and meet with the Solis Energy people, which is in Altamonte Springs, about a half-hour drive from where I am. I'm going to go and talk about pole-mounted power systems. And if possible, I'm going to try and shoot some video so we can share it on a future TWiT. So if you need to go and put access points or security cameras up on a pole and you don't have access to traditional power, these guys might have some interesting solutions for you.
Very cool. Looking forward to that. Thank you, Cheebert. Well, like Cheebert said, it's been a pretty busy week in the enterprise. With iOS and Android dominant in the workforce, you kind of expect that enterprise security is going to be there, right? Well, We're going to talk about a wee bit security bug with the latest versions of iOS that when you connect to a malicious Wi-Fi network can actually do some malicious things to your device. Not good. We also have a great guest today. Does your organization deploy applications to the cloud and there maybe even be API driven? Well, do you maybe even maintain your own authorization stack for your API or maybe other properties of the cloud? Well, today we have Nathaniel Coffing. He's co-founder and CSO of Cloud Entity. And he is going to take us through how organizations can have better fine-grained authorization with even some policy enforcement there as well. But first, like we always do, we go ahead and take you through this week's blips. Now, normally when you think about botnets, you think virtual machines, right? They scale them out. But it seems that ransomware groups are actually now taking advantage of VMs more and more to actually compromise networks. By using virtual machines as part of the process, ransomware attackers are able to conduct their activity with additional subletting because running the payload without a virtual environment reduces the chances of activity being discovered until it's too late and the ransomware has encrypted the files on the host machine. Now, during a recent investigation into an attempted ransomware attack, cybersecurity researchers at Symantec found that the ransomware operations had been using VirtualBox, a legitimate form of open source virtual machine software to actually run instances of Windows 7 to aid the installation of ransomware. Now, the motivation behind the tactic is actually being stealth. That's right. In order to avoid raising suspicions here or triggering the antivirus software, the ransomware payload will hide within a VM machine running separately on the machine on its host. And it can then access the host machine's files and directories via shared folders, which cyber criminals can exploit to actually allow the payload hosted in the virtual machine to actually encrypt the files on the computer itself. Now, while researchers haven't been able to fully identify the ransomware discovered running in the virtual machine, clues on as to how the malware operated provide strong indications that it was the Conti, a notorious form of ransomware used by cyber criminals in a number of high-profile campaigns, including the ransomware attack against the Ireland's HSC Health Service. Now, in my experience, when you see nefarious groups trying to a new tactic that actually works, it usually leads to other groups doing it as well. Well, what does this mean? Well, it means that you better start securing those hypervisors and your VMs and not sharing your host machine resources or access unless you trust the virtual hard disks you attach. This also includes copy and pasting to and from the host machine. When in doubt, zero trust.
Well, first came attack. Now get ready for defend. On June 22nd, Federal Research and Development Organization MITRE released its initial framework for creating a common language for defensive capabilities and technologies, which they're dubbing DEFEND, in much the same way that the organization's ATT&CK framework has created a foundation for analyzing and discussing attacker tactics. Funded by the NSA, the framework aims to define specific atomic security capabilities, also known as digital artifacts, so that researchers, cybersecurity professionals, and vendors can analyze the capabilities of specific products, match attack techniques to defenses, and conduct research on specific scenarios. By breaking down cybersecurity products into their capabilities, the Defend Matrix can help buyers make decisions based on technical features, not marketing. MITRE hopes to hit a semantic sweet spot, specific enough to give cybersecurity professionals the information they need, but general enough for the framework to be applied broadly, says Peter Kaloromakis, the creator of DEFEND and principal cybersecurity engineer at MITRE. DEFEND will focus on the security controls available through products and capabilities custom created by companies. Broken down into 17 different defensive actions in 5 broad categories, harden, detect, isolate, deceive, and evict, the DEFEND database has nearly 100 specific security controls, tactics, and functions organized along the lines of MITRE's popular ATT&CK framework. MITRE has opened up the DEFEND framework for comments and hopes to spur additional analyses of how effectively products provide coverage against particular attacks.
Okay, so this story comes from Ars Technica, and some hackers are using what people are calling unknown user accounts that are targeting Zyxel firewalls and VPN devices. Well, so Zyxel is warning customers of active and ongoing attacks that are targeting a range of the company's firewalls and other types of security appliances. In an email, the company said that targeted devices included security appliances that have been that have remote management or SSL VPN enabled, namely in the USG / Zywall, USG Flex, ATP, and VPN series running on-premise ZLD firmware. That's Zebra Lima Delta firmware. So the language in the email is very terse, but it appears to say that the attacks targeting devices that are exposed to the internet. When the attackers succeeded in accessing the device, the email further appears to say that they are able to connect to previously unknown accounts hardwired into the devices. So they're saying, batten down the hatches. Quote, we're aware of the situation and have been working our best to investigate and resolve it. Basically, they say the threat actor attempts to access a device through the WAN connection. If successful, they are bypassing authentication and are establishing SSL VPN tunnels with unknown user accounts such as Zyxel_SylVPN, Zyxel_TS, Zyxel_VPN_test to manipulate the device's configuration. So the bottom line here, the message is, update often, and if possible, and I stress the word possible, consider for the moment turning off admin logins via the WAN interface, or at least until a patch is offered to fix this issue.
Do you use a NAS device, maybe even on your organization's network? Naughty, naughty. Maybe your home network? Well, some of them, like Western Digital MyBooks, actually look for access to the internet as well. And there's a reason why we say secure all your devices, because Western Digital has actually alerted customers to a critical bug in its MyBook Live storage drives, warning them that they disconnect the devices from the internet to protect the units from being remotely wiped. Eek. Now, in an advisory, the storage firm said MyBook Live and MyBook Live Duo devices were being, quote, compromised through an exploitation of a remote command execution vulnerability, CVE-2018-18472. Now, the exploit is described as a root remote command execution bug, which can be triggered by anyone who knows the IP address of the affected device, and it's currently, quote, being exploited in the wild in June, as of June 2021, for factory reset commands. Now, reports of the issue emerged on this past week after owners of the NAS devices took to Western Digital support forums to actually complain about the issue. In fact, some of the users actually are complaining of having all their files actually vanishing on them. Some of them talk about their device actually being reset randomly. Now, device logs published on Western Digital forums show the devices were remotely factory reset, although the culprits have not yet been found. Now, in a statement earlier this week, the company said it didn't believe its own servers were compromised, but NAS drives have a storied history of falling victim to malicious actors here. And in fact, April, Taiwanese storage giant QNAP urged customers to update their devices in the face of two specifically targeted ransomware strains, QLocker and Xrakes. Now, if there's nothing else, this drives home the 3-2-1 backup rule for your organization and from your actual home data too as well. Plus, be skeptical about placing unmanaged NAS devices on your network and ensure they're actually secured out of the box. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, the bites. But before we get to the bites, we have to thank a really great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Bitwarden. Now, what's the easiest way for businesses and individuals to store, share, and sync sensitive data? Well, that's right. Bitwarden. It's a really great tool and it's open source. Now, Bitwarden is the only open source cross-platform password manager that can be used at home, on the go, or at work, and is trusted by millions of individuals, teams, and organizations worldwide. Now, businesses need to empower employees to follow password management best practices. Now, by giving your employees Bitwarden, they can securely store credentials across personal and business worlds. Now, every Bitwarden account begins with the creation of a personal vault, and you control the vault at all times. Now, use Bitwarden for your business. Convince your organization they need to use Bitwarden, because when an individual joins a team or a company, they can be assigned to the organizational vault for access to shared credentials. They can have quicker access, means quicker productivity. It's fully customizable. It adjusts features using enterprise policies to adapt to your business needs. Bitwarden also just released a few new features, including Bitwarden Send, a fully encrypted method to transmit sensitive information, whether text or files, directly to anyone. Plus, team members can generate unique and secure passwords for every site and ensure passwords are not used more than once. You'll minimize the risk of using weak and vulnerable passwords. Now, you'll get enterprise-grade security. Bitwarden conducts third-party security audits, and it's compliant with major privacy and security standards, including GDPR, CCPA, HIPAA, and SOC 2, and unite your existing systems with Bitwarden using SSO authentication, directory services, or even powerful APIs and a fully featured command line interface. Now, their end-to-end encrypted vault helps mitigate phishing attacks by storing passwords and more. Interested in a business plan? Well, Bitwarden has plans for all sizes. Now, their team's organization option is a $3 a month per user where you can share private data securely with your coworkers, department, or your entire organization. This plan also has full management of user groups. Now, for enterprises, use Bitwarden's enterprise organization plan for just $5 a month per user. Store business secrets securely and enable enterprise policies, SSO authentication, and an option to actually self-host. Want to learn how Bitwarden organizations work? Well, check out their free organization plan. It includes two users who can store and share secure passwords. Now, Bitwarden believes that everyone should have access to basic password security tools. Now, individuals can use their basic free account forever for an unlimited number of passwords across any number of devices or upgrade anytime to their premium account for less than a dollar a month, giving you premium password security management and features. Now, if you're looking for secure password storage for your entire family, well, their family organization option gives up to six users of premium features for only $3.33 a month. Using the Bitwarden Cloud, you can get started in no time or self-host if preferred. Monitor and manage security vulnerabilities using the Bitwarden Vault Health Reports. Identify exposed, reused, weak, or potentially compromised passwords, as well as any items in your vault with inactive 2FA. Get started with a free Teams or Enterprise trial of a Teams or Enterprise plan at bitwarden.com/twit or try it for free across devices as an individual user. That's bitwarden.com/twit. And we thank Bitwarden for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now time for the bias. We actually get to pick a couple news stories and we go deeper dive into them. And today we have a couple good ones. Now, you probably all connect your device to a Wi-Fi network, whether it's in a hotel or maybe even a library or whatnot. Well, mobile device OSs, they continue to advance themselves over time by also providing extension points into their kernel or to their service layers to allow third parties or OEMs to plug in there. And an example we'll give you here is when you connect to a Wi-Fi network, sometimes it requires you to pop up a web login box, a UI there that to actually log in first, like a hotel does that. Now, iOS is known to allow these integration points, usually at a much slower pace than, let's say, Android. However, just recently, a new bug has surfaced as it relates to an integration point for iOS's Wi-Fi settings. In fact, there's a bug in iOS that disables Wi-Fi connectivity when a device is joined a network that uses a booby-trapped name. Now, researchers actually disclosed this over the weekend. In fact, by connecting to a Wi-Fi network that uses the SSID pound P, pound S, pound S, pound S, pound S, pound N. We got all those, bunch of quotes there. iPhones and iPads lose the ability to join the network or any other networks going forward. Now, reverse engineer Carlo Hsu actually found this. Unfortunately, when issues like these are made public, rather than maybe bug bounties or whatnot, hackers and trolls just jump on it and take advantage of it and before they're actually patched. Now, Carl actually is the owner of the hacking resource group Secret Club, initially saw how easy it was to actually restore it and remove the Wi-Fi capabilities. Eventually, he found that users could reset network functionality by opening settings, general reset, reset network settings. Now, Apple representatives didn't respond to emailed questions, including if there was plans to fix the bug and whether it affected Mac OS or other Apple offerings as well. Now, Carl said in the internet message that the bug is caused by the internal logging functionality in the iOS Wi-Fi daemon, which uses the SSID inside of a format expression. Now, the condition makes it possible in some cases for unauthorized formatting strings to be injected into sensitive parts of the highly fortified Apple OS. And he and other experts, however, said that there's a little chance of this bug actually being exploited maliciously. Unfortunately, a quick analysis of the bug by an outside researcher agreed that it isn't likely the bug could be exploited, but they actually execute malicious code. Now, the analysis also found that the bug appears to stem from a flaw in the iOS login component that uses the concat function to actually effectively convert the SSID string into a format string before it's written to the log file. Now, they felt that because the strings weren't echoed or into any sensitive parts of the iOS, the hacker is unlikely to succeed about abusing this. Not all researchers actually agree here. In fact, another research group from security firm AirEye, for instance, said that the technique could be used to actually bypass security appliances that sit at the perimeter of a network to block unauthorized data from entering or exiting. Sounds bad. Now, the crash is caused by that what researchers call an uncontrolled formatting string bug. Flaw arises when corrupted user input is in the format of a string parameter in certain functions written in C and C-style languages. They use the format tokens such as pound-s or pound-x and can, in some cases, print data to memory. Now, the bug was initially considered harmless, but most recently, researchers actually were able to exploit this thing. Okay, so I'm going to bring my co-host back in, because this is not good, and if the fact that it's in just the normal versions of iOS makes it even worse. So I want to start with Curtis first, because it looks like, you know, from an enterprise standpoint, this could be bad. Now, Apple's done some work to actually snap to enterprise requirements going forward. However, people still enter the Wi-Fi IDs themselves, and sometimes they connect to different networks outside of their organization before they're actually presented to MDM or other software that controls the device. Is this surprising that this even bug exists, Curtis?
Surprising that in 2021... large enterprise developers aren't doing type checking? Yeah, I think that's surprising. That would seem to me to be falling into the basic blocking and tackling category of professional work. With that said, I tend to agree with the developers who say, or the security analysts who say, that as it's currently presented, this is not a terrifically dangerous vulnerability. I mean, it would require the user doing something egregiously stupid, always a possibility, and there being an additional level of exploit below what's been discovered so far. I think the real danger in something like this is once this type of vulnerability has been found, you know that there are going to be researchers out there doing every combination of characters possible to see if this is exploitable using different character sets. And to the extent that it is, it becomes more troublesome. So I think this is a serious warning sign for Apple and its users. And frankly, more than a little bit of an embarrassment for the developers who let this get through.
Yeah, I agree. I think that, you know, string formatting bugs in this day and age, especially ones that are revolving around tokenizing those strings and then checking the validity of the string, seems very strange to me, especially in this particular case. Now, Cheebert, I want to throw it to you, because now Curtis said that, you know, hey, what, the user's got to do something stupid here. They got to enter in a really weird SSID here. But is that, what do you think? Is that the only way they can get into trouble here?
You know, I don't know. This is something that I'd be tempted to try in my home lab. See, one of the things, this actually gives me a real big case of deja vu, because there was a hack back in, God, I can't even remember when, where someone used a username that would literally send formatting codes on an HP smart terminal, and it would actually force the cursor, the active cursor, up into the top right left-hand corner of the screen scrape a certain number of characters, and then return it into the buffer. Basically, they were grabbing valid user IDs and returning it back to a type buffer. So this particular one was going to do some really nasty things and so forth. So anyway, going on, what I'm thinking is, has anyone tried this by putting those special characters at the end of an SSID? And in that SSID, will it still do the same type of formatting error and be able to get you into, you know, what is in essence protected memory? I could see this happening, especially if you're using a relatively simple captive portal, the sign-on screen. A lot of the captive portals on consumer-grade Wi-Fi devices are not real sophisticated, and it's actually running on really old versions of Apache, stripped-down Apache, so I could see it happening. So I don't agree. I think this is one of those tip-of-the-iceberg-type attacks. I think as more research starts happening, I would imagine that there's going to be a few more ways of exploiting this, just because I've seen it before. I've seen this type of thing before, and we don't seem to have learned.
I agree. I think one thing that's interesting here, you said, hey, let's see if we can add it to the end of the string. You know, we have, you know, I just had this device over here next to me that has a UPC code on it or a QR code on it, where a device can actually scan it using their phone. What if there's embedded stuff in there, right? I mean, another question is, what if that's people just go ahead and connect to it, thinking they're connecting to the device, and now you are, you know, you basically, with a sticker, you've embedded some malicious code that can actually allow for remote execution or taking over the device.
Oh, yeah, and especially because there's a whole bunch of products out there that are being sold all over the place where it's a little nice, beautiful little chunk of wood, has a QR code on the top, but it's also an NFC device inside, and you can program it for anything. It's meant to make it easier for your guests and friends to go and set up and jump onto your Wi-Fi, but you can put anything on there. You know, I had fun using the NFC cards that are left over in someone's booth. I actually reprogrammed them using my Android tablet, and I set it up so that if I got it, I slipped it into someone's pocket next to their phone, and it got the phone to go and text me a message saying, hi, I'm been owned. I could see that happening with other things.
Right. All right. Well, we want to leave enough time for the guests. Thank you, guys. Well, let's move on to the guest time, because that's my favorite part of the show. That's coming up next. But before we do and we get to the guests, let's go ahead and thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Thanks to Canary. And the last thing anyone wants or needs right now is a data breach, right? Well, rather than the villain lying in wait, you may have a hero, and that's Thanks to Canary. You may have heard of a few. Companies usually find out too late that they've been compromised, even after they've already spent millions of dollars on IT security. They find out it wasn't enough. Now, Canary has completely changed the game here. It's designed to be installed and configured in minutes without all the complex installs and required specialists. Now, what happens when someone breaches your network? Well, they prowl the network looking for juicy content. They'll browse Active Directory for file servers and explore file shares looking for documents. They'll try to default passwords against network devices and web services, and they'll scan for open services across the network. Canaries can be deployed throughout the entire network, and you can make them look identical to a router, a switch, a NAS server, a Linux box, or a Windows server, so attackers won't know they've been caught. Now, Thanks Canaries are designed to look like the things hackers want to get to. You can put fake files on them or enroll them into Active Directory. When attackers investigate further, they give themselves away and you're instantly notified. Now, you can also use Canary tokens. These are tiny tripwires that you can drop into hundreds of places. They follow the Thanks Canary philosophy of trivial to deploy with a ridiculously high quality of signal. Now, if an alert happens, Canary will notify you the way you want. Plus, you won't be overwhelmed with false alarms. You can set up to get alerts by either email or text message right on your console there within Slack, or you can even use webhooks or get via syslog or even straight through the really great API. It gives you the ability to choose the option that works best for your business. Now, it's important that companies know two things when it comes to data breaches. One, hackers will usually take the path of least resistance, and that's right, your staff. And two, it takes an average of 191 days for a company to realize that there's been a data breach. And that's a long time for a hacker to be on your network. That's where Thanks Canary comes in to help solve the problem. The people behind Canary have been in the security game for almost two decades. That's right. They've trained companies, militaries, and governments on how to break into the networks. And that's the knowledge they've used to build Canary. That's right. Things Canaries are deployed all over the world on all 7 continents and are one of the best tools against those data breaches. Visit canary.tools/twit, and for just $7,500 per year, you'll get 5 Canaries, your own hosted console, upgrade, support, and maintenance. And if you use code TWIT in the How to Hear About Us box, you'll get a 10% off the price for life. We know you'll love Things Canary, but if you're not happy, you can always return your Canaries with their 2-month money-back guarantee for a full refund. That's canary.tools/twit. And enter the code TWIT in the How Do You Hear About Us box. And we thank Things Canary for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's my favorite part of the show. We actually get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Ryan. Today we have Nathaniel Coffing. He's co-founder and CSO of Cloud Entity. Welcome to the show, Nathaniel.
Thank you, Lou. Pleasure to be here.
So our audience loves to hear people's origin stories. I love to start with this question because they really do love to hear people's journey through tech. Can you maybe take us through a short journey through tech and what brought you to Cloud Entity?
Absolutely. Well, as one of the co-founders, right, realizing the problem statement early on. And what I mean by that is, you know, been in the identity space for the last 2 decades, essentially, working with Sun Microsystems right from the get-go of the, identity formation. And seeing that the value of identity really wasn't being realized within the enterprise. And what I mean when I say that is we've done a great job at authenticating users, but we've totally missed on authorization, right? It's really been very coarse-grained. And we've stacked some very powerful protocols like OAuth OIDC. We've stacked them on top of monolithic applications, and we haven't been able to realize the value that's just inherent in those standards. So we saw that happening, and then we saw the need, right, with cloud adoption, distributed services, to really find ways to automate, add governance, and then to start to look at authorization slightly differently. No longer is it just what can I do within an application, but also what can an application know about me? And what can the application share?
Right. So, like, you know, I'm an API developer. I develop lots of applications of different platforms, usually API driven, and they're usually scalable by using things like microservices, and they're distributed and redundant. But one thing I find very difficult is just ensuring that these things are always authenticated correctly, but also that I'm authorizing that user correctly, and then I'm like flowing that authorization to all my services. What are some of the challenges that you're seeing? Obviously, that's one of the challenges. What are some of the other challenges from that perspective that you're seeing organizations when they kind of deploy those types of applications?
Yeah, what we're seeing is that organizations like to hard code, right? Developers like to hard code authorization into the applications, right? It's been done that way for the last, 20 some odd, actually more like 50 or 60 some odd years. And what we're finding is that organizations can't actually meet, the regulatory requirements, the consent requirements, the privacy requirements that are mandated in the modern era by hard coding their applications to their authorization constructs. So what we're first doing is externalizing those. Second big thing that we're seeing, particularly in the API space, is as front-end services go out, what we'd call historically north-south traffic, go out to the client apps, right? They're having a hard time maintaining the user identity or the requester identity to the backend API services. Right. And that's something that we're seeing both from an authorization construct, but also just maintaining the continuity of authentication and the chain of custody of transaction as it goes from, my end user's app into maybe a partner API into my own, enterprise backend APIs as well. So there's a huge problem that organizations are facing as they modernize, which is, how do I constrain this all within, either a B2B2C, a B2C ecosystem. And that's really where authorization, externalized, centralized, but with distributed policy decision, distributed policy enforcement comes to fruition.
So before we get into different sectors of the market, because I think that's important to go into different sectors and figure out how they're handling this and dealing with this as well. But one thing I'm curious about, you talked about how obviously authorization can be done usually at the server, but then obviously have that flow to all the other like client-side applications mm-hmm. and so on. So how does that work for things like if you have an application on a device and that device might go offline or online, how do you guarantee that the appropriate authorization is still there? It's still kind of persisted there.
Yeah. So what we've done is we've used a very distributed policy decision point where you can actually push the policies right out to the edge of the service or the edge of the API. So now your new perimeter, as we all like to talk about the ever-evolving, distributed perimeter, your new perimeter is literally wrapped around, your microservice, your Lambda function, your Kubernetes pod. And so because it's co-located there, so long as, you know, it can't communicate with the mothership, right, to pull back updated policies or pull back updated data, it's actually able to continue to make these distributed policy decision points, you know, for set periods of time. And so whether that's an IoT service or whether that's a microservice, right, it doesn't matter to us because they're all functioning in the same manner, making API calls and needing to have this delegated authorization construct as well as the ability to maintain the continuity of the requester, whether that's a user or another service.
Right. Does that make sense? Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I think one thing I'm curious about, and I think we wanted to jump into this because it's important that we know, obviously, different sectors of the market, they have different requirements, different compliances. Now, let's talk a little bit about banks. How is identity management and maybe authorization different for banks?
Well, I think that's a great use case because, you know, when we think about valuable APIs or valuable services, you know, the first thing that comes to mind is the ones that are actually transferring money, right? AKA banks. And what we've seen, you know, particularly in Europe, Australia now, and also South America is the adoption of what's called open banking. Open banking is really just a precept for an API driven economy. And that API driven economy is how do I share data, right, out to my partners, out to my customers? How do I build, you know, rapid B2B to C or B2P to C or B2B to B2C networks, being able to both constrain how data is flowing across those API pipes, but then also make sure that I'm treating customer privacy appropriately, meaning customer needs to be able to say they want to share data with me as the bank that they don't want me to share with a third party. Or they might say, yes, yeah, share my account data, you know, out to this third party, but only do it one time. Only do it three times, right? So being able to give them very fine-grained authorization capabilities around the consent data that they're sharing is part of the inclusion, part of the democratization of these financial services within open banking.
Right, right. And I'm interested to find out, like, obviously there's a lot of banking applications out there, the applications that usually interact or interface with your bank in the back end using their APIs. Now, does this work for, like, let's say if I'm using, like, a stocking service that pulls data from my or pulls money from the bank or needs to know information from the bank, can it maintain that authorization and restrict using policies and so on, like kind of like that server to server type communication, or is it usually just client to server?
It's both the north south client server as well as east west server to server, machine to machine, and that's really where I think the value, like, of our product comes to, you know, to wild fruition. What I mean when I say that is it's not just about can the pipes be connected, right? But it's also what's flowing through the pipes and bringing very fine-grained authorization around what data can service AC versus what data can service BC and even service C, which might be run by, let's say, a risky Russian partner who you don't necessarily trust implicitly.
Right, right. Now, you know, we talk a little bit about, obviously, talk about open banking. And of course, when we talk about open banking, one thing that I fear is the fact that now you have open banking, you have like a really much larger increased surface attack. Surface plane there for people to attack to. Well, what can we do to help that type of thing? What is this helping to do?
So what I really like, and I think open banking got absolutely right, was they literally set the gold standard for API security with what's called OAuth FAPI, right? Financial API. And it ranges from everything from what you call pairwise identifiers to mutual TLS, not just at the TLS layer, but also making sure you're tokens, right? In this case, JWT tokens are being signed by that client side certificate. So they've done a very good job at securing the API layer of who's talking to who and making sure that there's at least strong authentication happening. Now we're taking that another step further and being able to do a much better job of controlling how data is flowing from the client to the server and then from the server to other backend services. And that's really where that consent-based authorization and where that fine-grained authorization really build that ecosystem for how the services are going to interoperate, how they're going to function, and how they're going to share data.
Now, it sounds like obviously you're using a standard, you're using a way of, you know, the OAuth standard here, but how does that support these different regulatory and compliances like HIPAA and FINRA and FISMA, that kind of thing? Where do these go? How does it fit in for those?
So the big thing for HIPAA is really going to be about managing, allowing users to manage their own data. So you might say, I want this data attribute to be shared out to my doctor, who's allowed to share it out to my cardiologist, right? Or my general practitioner out to my cardiologist. So being able to bring that kind of fine-grained authorization around user consent, right? Around consent-based authorization. How am I going to share data? When I'm going to share data? Under what circumstances? What's my intent for sharing data? And intent-based authorization is a key function of it's called the logic intent pattern, is a key function of open banking and also reflected in the OAuth specs for 2.1 and 3.0. There's a few new things coming. One's called a grant management standard that's being that just got released into RFC. The second one is rich authorization requests. So you can do very fine-grained authorization constructs underneath OAuth. So you're making sure that you continue to use, right, an open standard to authorize what's happening under the covers.
Interesting. Well, I do want to bring my co-host back in because they're chomping at the bit here. Let's start with Chibert first. Chibert?
Well, my big question is, as an ex-federal auditor, what kinds of auditing do we have? Am I going to be able to meet the increasing auditing requirements that GDPR is rumored to have? And can I meet things like NISPOM, which is a federal classified world auditing requirement? You guys have a thing you call the authorization control plane. How granular do you get on allowing access to the logging, I guess, is my real question.
You know, so from an auditing perspective, you're absolutely right, right? And this is some of the richest data that you can see, because not only are you seeing that client server traffic, the north-south, but also the east-west traffic. And you're able to see both the API request, what's being passed to the API, as well as the API response, right? Because all of that's coming from the API gateway or from the Kubernetes cluster. So you actually have an extraordinarily rich source of data, right, that you should be feeding into Splunk or out into your SIM and doing some pretty comprehensive analysis on. Now, from your question, right, is the data's there, so how do I now protect that data? And so within our product, right, first of all, we're digitally signing that data. So you have tamper-proof audit, making sure that what's being captured is able to be used in the court of law, right, for defensibility. A second piece of that is within our own reporting platform, being able to have multiple roles around who can see what types of data, how that data is being exposed, and then obviously a graphical representation and machine learning processing around what's transpired in the last 15 minutes versus the last 30 days.
Okay, so real quick follow-up. Now that we've got all this rich data, one of the things that our friends at Splunk are talking about is having a rich query language, a way of basically telling the forest from the trees. How far do you guys go in that direction, or do you toss that grenade over to someone like Splunk?
I don't know if I'd call it a grenade, right? I would toss this very rich data, which is how Splunk monetizes, their platform, over to Splunk or over to, any SIM that's able to consume syslog or consume things coming out of a Kafka service bus. But we don't get into the actual query language itself. That's just out of the jurisdiction of our platform.
Thanks, Chibert. Curtis?
Thanks, Lou. Well, the thing that I'm really curious about, we've been hearing about the use cases, hearing about the value of this, but I'd like to talk about the cost of this and how that might apply to where it's put into play. I mean, is this the sort of system that is going to have a low enough overhead, and that's both in hard dollars and systems and personnel, to be applicable to a huge user base, let's say all of the users of a particular bank? Or is it really targeted for very high value applications and transactions? Is this one where some real analysis needs to be done about the value inherent in the transaction before your system is applied to the authentication and identity?
So it's the former, not the latter. So we were explicitly designed to scale. So our first customer said, we want to have 300 million people onboarded to start, a large telco in India, and start to ramp up to beyond 1 billion identities, right? That's users, services, things, all making up their own unique identities. So we were built to scale right from the get-go, right? And that's something we focused on. When we look at, from a performance perspective, how many token mints, how many authorizations, how do we get into the transactional authorization capabilities, right? Transactional tokens. We're looking at 100,000 plus transactions per second, even at some of our larger customers. If I translate that and say, well, what are the other people that are kind of adjacent or close to this space look like, right? What are the IDPs doing in the world? I look at about two orders of magnitude over what you can buy from off the shelf products, because born in the cloud, written in Go, lightning fast, focused on performance from day one. We knew we had to move into this transactional authorization model. And we knew the only way to do that is to control both what data is going over the wire, and then also policy decision points that are able to control what data flows down to the service or to the API.
Very good. Now, I'm fascinated. You mentioned a use case there in India. And So my question is whether your system is lightweight enough and easy enough for the user to navigate that it could play a role in reducing the number of what the World Bank likes to call the unbanked, those people, especially in developing nations, who for various reasons have not had access to traditional banks and financial instruments. I mean, this is a huge issue across much of the world, and it would be wonderful if there were steps towards a solution. Do you think your system is one of those?
So I do, and I think you pointed out very appropriately, right? Open banking is really about the democratization of banking, right? It's an inclusive a set of standards designed to bring on more, you know, potential customers, but also to bring banking and financial services out to the unbanked that are moving out to, you know, less developed countries, and ensuring that, you know, all of the citizens of those countries are able to have the same type of access to the same types of financial services that we've become accustomed to in North America or in Europe.
Very good. Well, you know, I'm the issue of expanding out and scalability on a truly mass scale is something that I'm really fascinated by and have been for years. With your system, you know, obviously here in North America, in Europe, in much of Asia, we've gotten past the point where the majority of people who are using mobile devices are using smartphones. But, you know, to go back to the developing nations, you still have a lot of people on feature phones, the old flip phones or things that don't have the lovely screens that we're used to. Now, is that an impediment for your system, or is yours broadly applicable enough so that even if the user has something like a feature phone, they can take advantage and authenticate themselves?
Yeah, so if the user has an HTTP enabled browser, I think is the easiest way to say it, right? That's kind of the bottom line. If they have a TCP stack that they're able to use, that's part of their phone OS or phone operating system, absolutely. If they don't, you know, if they have one of those, you know, kind of older Nokia flip phones, you know, that's still using T9, things of that nature, I don't think they're going to be able to join the open banking ecosystem in any way.
Now, I do have a question. So obviously there's lots of financial organizations out there. There are a lot of smaller, larger applications. How big of a customer do you need to be? We talked to a large customer. How big do you need to be to actually make this worthwhile, to actually implement all this?
So the organizations can actually be a varied size. You know, and they can consume a SaaS, right, that's providing all of this with some on-prem policy decision points, or at least hybrid available policy decision points. Or they can use, you know, an entirely infrastructure based in their VPC, right? So it can run from a small mom and pop shop that just wants to join the open banking ecosystem, maybe do some aggregation of financial data, or it can be, you know, your Bank of America. So it really runs the full gamut. It's very easy to use, and it brings in kind of this element of data traceability, understanding exactly where the data originated, who authenticated you, what is the context that came with that authentication, what entitlements maybe, what consent was granted by your users, all the way down to the enforcement, which again is co-located with your API gateways, supporting, you know, all the major, the big guys, you know, the Apigee, Kongs, you know, AWS, Azure, et cetera. Or Kubernetes, or even your monolithic kind of more traditional services.
Now, so I'm always interested. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, no, please finish.
Oh, no, I think one thing I was going to kind of elaborate on is I was digging through your website a little bit and kind of like around the protocol and how it's implemented. And I noticed a little bit of talk about how, and you kind of alluded to this, how the fact that when something happens, your authorization, your system kind of gets notified in real time, and you can do things with that notification. Can you maybe kind of take us through the flow, that workflow, and what the notification system does and how a real-world trigger can happen?
Sure. Great question. So what's happening under the covers, right, is we're doing transactional token mints, moving that token session length away from, you know, minutes or hours and moving that down into seconds and milliseconds. And that's one of the reasons scale is so imperative to what we're doing. Now, as you're minting those tokens, right, you're actually able to take more data on your ingress to your token minting, right? And that data could come from your WAF, could come from your CDN, could come from your SIM, could come from a fraud engine. And that data gets flowed through, changes your risk level, changes your authorization constructs, and allows you to perform in transaction additional MFAs, you know, additional ways of trying to reduce that risk so you can process that. And this is critical when we start to think about customer experience, because I want to keep the bar as low as possible, as friction-free as possible for my customers up until the point that I see things that are worrisome, and then raise that bar and say, you know, time for an MFA right in the middle of, you know, a transaction that, or an application usage that may not know anything about MFA. So it's a very powerful way of bringing those together.
Yeah, unfortunately, we're running just a little bit low on time, but I do want to give you maybe a chance, Nathaniel, to tell the folks at home, and especially some of the organizations out there, where they can go to learn more a little bit about this and where maybe they can get started and contact you.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity to be here, first of all. Love the show. So one of the great places to start, right, is obviously just our website. Make sure you understand, you know, where we are, what we're doing. From a technical perspective, really, we're acting as essentially a service IDP, bringing together your user construct from existing IDPs, leveraging things like Rego, which is the underlying policy language for OPA, and then pulling that all together in distributed policy decision points that we call the microperimeter, which has been adopted as a NIST infrastructure for protecting microservices. So being able to bring all the data together to make the most intelligent authorization decisions you can at the edge of your services, enabling your developers, enabling your business, enabling velocity across the entire ecosystem.
Nathaniel, thank you so much for being here. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks, Lou.
Well, folks, you've done it again. You sat through another hour of the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. So tune your podcatcher to Twyatt. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to my co-host, starting with our very own Mr. Brian Chi. Chibert, what's going on for you in the coming week, and where can people find you?
Well, I'm going to go visit the guys over at Solus Energy because I'm really interested in some of their power solutions so that I can put up access points and cameras in some interesting places. If you ever want, just, you know, toss me a ping. I'm on Twitter. I'm ADVNETLAB. So one of the cute things that I know some of you have asked me about is power systems. They have one you can actually stick it right in between the photovoltaic cell and the socket on a street light and tap power so that you can run access points and things like that. Really cool. And I know at least four or five of you have asked me that question in the past, and I'll hopefully have some cool video to show. Anyway, hit me on Twitter, or you're welcome to drop me an email. I'm chebert@twit.tv. That's spelled C-H-E-E-B-E-R-T. Or if you'd like, why don't you drop a line to twyatt@twit.tv, and that hits all the hosts. So we'd love to hear from you. We have viewers on every continent, and you have certainly made your opinions known. We'd like to hear more. And as much as possible, when I book guests, I try to go through my list of topics that you have suggested. Anyway, everybody take care and stay safe.
Thank you, Chief. I appreciate you being here. Well, folks, we also have to thank Mr. Curtis Franklin as well. Curtis, what's going on for you in the coming weeks, and where can people find you?
Well, I'm going to be doing a lot of research and a lot of presentation putting together. I've got the Black Hat presentation to do. I'm also working on couple of webinars that I'm going to be presenting later on this year on little things like how to turn aware employees into real cybersecurity allies. Let people know more details about those coming up. But in the meantime, be sure to follow me on Twitter. I'm at KG4GWA, or on Instagram at Kurt_Franklin. Look forward to hearing from you directly on either one of those.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate you being here. Well, folks, I also have to thank you as well. You're the person who drops in each and every week to listen to our show and get your enterprise and IT goodness. I want to make it easy for you to listen and get your enterprise news each and every week. So go to our show page right now, twit.tv/Twiat. There you'll find all the amazing back episodes, the show notes, the co-host information, guest information, and all the links we do during the show. But of course, more importantly, next to those videos, you'll get those helpful subscribe and download links. That's right. Support the show by getting your audio version or your video version of your choice. Listen on any one of your devices. Pick it on any one of your podcatcher applications as well, because we're on all of them. Definitely subscribe, because it's the best way to support the show. Plus, you may have heard, that's right, Club Twit. It's a members-only ad-free podcast service with a bonus Twit Plus feed, plus that you can get, you can't really get that anywhere else, and it's only $7 a month. Now, one of my favorite things about Club Twit is the exclusive access to the members only Discord channel. There's a great set of people in there. We do some great chatting and we get talking and discussing both during hours, after hours, all kinds of stuff. Really great, interesting content there. Love it. Definitely join Club Twit and be part of the movement. Go to twit.tv/Club Twit. Now, after you subscribe, you can impress your friends, your family, your coworkers with the gift of Twiat, because you know what? We talk about a lot of fun tech topics on the show, and I definitely think that they will find it fun and interesting as well. So definitely share the gift of Twiat. Now, if you've already subscribed and you're available on Fridays at 1:30 p.m. Pacific time, we do the show live. That's right, live.twit.tv. Come see how the pizza's made, the behind the scenes, all the blips and the blurps. Definitely come and see all the banter we have and the fun we hear here at Twit. Plus, if you're going to watch the live show, might as well jump into the live chat room as well. That's irc.twit.tv. We really love the chat room. I have some great characters in there each and every week. We really appreciate it. And sometimes the guests jump in there as well. So thank you guys for being here. And of course, definitely jump into the chat room live and be part of it as well. Now, you know what? I want to thank all of you, and I also want to thank, and if you have your ideas and some thoughts, definitely jump over to twitter.com/LouMM. You can definitely discuss some stuff, maybe throw some ideas just like Chibert, and of course, maybe talk about things we can do on the show, or maybe some add some new segments, that kind of thing. Definitely jump over there and have a conversation. I want to thank all of you, and I also want to tell you, hey, I also post some Microsoft stuff out there. You know what? We've had some really great things in the last couple of weeks. Windows 11's coming out. Office scripts. Definitely check all of that. And of course, check out developers.microsoft.com/office as well for all the latest and greatest. I do want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa. They continue to support This Week in Enterprise Tech each and every week, and we couldn't do the show without them. So thank you for all of their support. I want to thank all the engineers and staff at Twit. Of course, I also want to thank Mr. Brian Chibert, one more time, just because not only is he's our co-host, but he's also our tireless producer as well. He does all the show bookings and all the plannings for the show, and we really couldn't do the show without him. So thank you, Chibert, for all your support and all your help over the years. Now, before we sign out, we have to thank our editor, Victor. He's the one that makes us look smooth and fluid throughout the show. So thank you, Victor, for all your support behind the scenes. And of course, our TD for today, Mr. Amp Pruitt. He is a very talented guy, and he's had some really great content over here at Twit. So, Ant, why don't you tell us a little bit about what's coming up this week for some of your stuff?
Well, Mr. Lou, I've had a great time chatting with the awesome Miss Lisa Carney, and apparently, according to all of my DMs and emails and inboxes, it was quite a polarizing episode. So go ahead and check out Hands on Photography at twit.tv/hop. And check out my discussion with the amazing photo finisher and photographer, Miss Lisa Carney. And it's all with her iPhone.
Fantastic, fantastic. Looking forward to it. Thank you, Ant, and thank you to you as well. And until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.
Android may be just another operating system, but when you check out All About Android, you'll realize that Android's also a ton of fun. Join me, Jason Howell, and my co-hosts, Florence Ion and Ron Richards, and a whole slew of guests that we invite on the show every week. Every Tuesday, in fact, we talk about the latest Android news, hardware, apps, and we answer a ton of your Android-related questions as well. Don't miss All About Android at twit.tv.